than anything that the soldiers in the West can do, our commanders in the West can do, even if reinforced from my army. And this is what I think my campaign will do. It will let me pull the war out of Virginia. If I go north, the enemy will have to follow me. It will allow us to gather the logistical bounty from our farmers this summer, take the pressure off Virginia, and I can gather supplies north of the Potomac River. This is much like he argued during the Antietam campaign. He also believed that he could strengthen the peace Democrats in the North. Lee read the newspapers. He knew the Copperheads were a problem for Lincoln. He thought the presence of his army would help. Almost at the bottom of his list, but nonetheless on Lee's list, was at least a slim hope that a really successful campaign north of the Potomac might actually rekindle chances that either England or France would decide to help the Confederacy. As a sop to those who argued that he should send troops west, Lee said that if he were really successful, that maybe Grant and Rosecrans would have to weaken their armies to strengthen Union armies in the east. Now, Lee's been heavily criticized for this. He's been called a man who had Virginia blinders on. He didn't understand the big picture of the war. He always was just thinking of his own army. But in fact, I think he realized better than any of his critics that the East was more important psychologically. It was more important in terms of morale. Lee knew that his army by that point had become the most important national institution in the Confederacy, and that anything he did would likely resonate more powerfully, both in a positive sense with the Confederates and a negative sense with the North. Well, in the end, Jefferson Davis decided not to go against Lee's wishes. He went along with his best commander, and the result would be the second invasion of the North by Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia. And let's look at the initial stage of that campaign. It initially went well. Lee's army, back up to 75,000 men. James Longstreet had rejoined the army after the Battle of Chancellorsville. The army's now divided into three pieces. It had been Longstreet and Stonewall Jackson before. Now it's Longstreet commanding the First Corps, a man named Richard Ewell commanding most of Jackson's old Second Corps, and A.P. Hill, not to be confused with D.H. Hill. There are two Hills who've been fighting in the East. A.P. Hill would command the new Third Corps. By early June, the army was ready to move, and just before it went north, on June 9th, there was a huge cavalry battle near Culpeper, Virginia, where the army was staging for its invasion. Union cavalry under Alfred Pleasanton surprised Jeb Stuart and his Confederate cavalry and fought in this battle of Brandy Station an enormous, sprawling cavalry action, the biggest ever in the Western Hemisphere. Part of this action took place troopers fighting on foot, but part of it was an old-fashioned swinging sabers and firing revolvers at each other kind of fight. It involved 10,000 men on each side. In the end, Jeb Stuart was able to hold on and drive the Federals back, but it was a very close call for his command, and it would have repercussions. Southern newspapers said Stuart had been surprised. That was humiliating for Stuart. Stuart had always had his own way with the Federal cavalry, and the Battle of Brandy Station seemed to be, at least to many Confederates behind the lines, almost a defeat for Stuart and his cavalry. A few words about Stuart are in order here. He's a very important figure in the war in the Eastern Theater. He's a Virginian, a young man, 30 years old at this stage of the war, a West Pointer, had fought in the Indian Wars in the 1850s. He's a very romantic figure and a real contrast in some ways. He is, on the one hand, a man thoroughly caught up in the romance of war. The women loved Jeb Stuart. They would put garlands on his horse. They'd strew petals in front of his horse when he went by. He's a very romantic figure. He liked to go to balls and stage them. He had a banjo player who accompanied his staff, and they would pick out music on the banjo and sing. He affected a gaudy uniform. He wore very high boots. He wore a plume in his hat. He had a scarlet-lined cape and a big gold sash. Cut a very dashing figure, very well armed. He had a big Lamat revolver and a saber and God knows what else hooked onto his saddle somewhere. He made quite an impression.